Hello, hello. Welcome to Be Bold America. I'm your host, Jill Cody, along with my co-host, Dr. Pettus Perry. How are you today, Pettus? Whoops, do we not have Pettus? So let me just get started with introducing the program. Our program today is, What's Up, Doc? What's Going On With Our Schools? Founding Father James Madison said, "It is universally admitted that a well-instructed people alone can be permanently a free people." In states all over the country, classrooms have become culture war battlegrounds. The National Education Association stated that 55% of America's educators are considering leaving the profession. In Texas, it is 70%. Teachers experience less support from parents. They must deal with political rhetoric, potential gun violence, calls for banning books, diminishing respect, and inferior pay. Watch Florida. It is a canary in the coal mine. As one Florida teacher said of their new state's curriculum, quote, "There was this Christian nationalism philosophy that was just baked into everything that was there." Another high school teacher said about what is happening in public education, "It is the biggest attack on freedom in a classroom that I have ever seen. We have big things to do." Eliza, do we have Pettus on the line yet? Not yet. Okay.
Can you hear me?
Oh, I hear Pettus. Hey, Pettus. Welcome.
Jill, I don't know about these technical issues
here. I know.
Here.
It's a blessing and a curse. You know?
It is. But you did a great job.
Oh, I tried. So how are you today?
I'm doing okay. It's nice and sunny up here. I hope the same down your way.
Yes, it is. And also, I wanted you to know that it is my husband's and my 23rd meet-iversary.
I love it.
23 years ago today, Jerry and I met.
Congratulations.
And we like to celebrate our meet-iversary because we've only been married 8 of those 23 years.
A little slow on the uptake, huh,
Jill? A little slow, yeah.
Congratulations to both of you.
Thank you very much. As my husband would say, we can't rush into these things.
I'll have a talk with Jerry.
Oh, good. Okay, thank you. Pettus, would you like to introduce our bold guest today?
I would. Thank you very much. Dr. Denine Gust was elected and sworn in as the Monterey County Superintendent of Schools in January 2019 for her first term and will begin her second term of office in January 2023. Dr. Gust is a 35-year veteran educator with a doctorate in educational leadership. She's been an administrator for over 25 years and has received numerous awards for her service in education and her service to the community, including the 2021 Ruth Vreeland Memorial Public Official of the Year Award. With a lens on community and equity, Dr. Gust is focused on strengthening community engagement and improving educational outcomes. Welcome to Be Bold America, Dr. Gust.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Pettus and Jill, for that beautiful introduction and for the opportunity to join you today. And Jill, I have to say, congratulations on your meet-iversary.
My meet-iversary.
That's so exciting. My husband and I have been married 8 years now as well.
Oh,
but
really?
We knew each other in high school, so we totally understand how important it is to recognize that first moment.
Thank you so much. And I'm so glad to, I'm sorry for the rough start there. I always hold my breath to make sure that the guest is there too. And I'm so glad you are. And Dr. Gust, just thank you for joining us today. Since both of us, both Pettus and I are educators, we have become alarmed about the increasing and numerous threats facing public education today. First, I wanted to say that Pettus and I know your position is nonpartisan. I needed to do that when I worked for municipalities and the university. I have my poker face, be nonpartisan. Yet, personally, I think it must be difficult, and I can say this, you don't need to say this, but difficult to remain so, since it is not the Democratic Party garnering forces to ban books or calling for hardening our schools instead of doing something to stop gun violence, for example. Pettus?
Thank you. Yeah, and Dr. Gus, we also wanted to say that during our show, we may refer to what Florida and Texas are doing because those two states are taking the lead to reshape our nation's public school systems. So if you have any thoughts about what's going on in those states and how those relate to your work in California, we'd love to hear those from you. So having said all of that, let's get going with our first set of questions. So for those of us who don't understand education, what does your job as the Monterey Superintendent of Schools entail, and how do politics shape your job?
Wow, so that's a great question. And I'm so happy that you did note there that my position is a nonpartisan position. So while I may have, you know, personal thoughts on many of the topics we'll talk about today, I'm going to very much keep my comments in my role as the nonpartisan County Superintendent of Schools.
Yes, Dr. Gus, you know, if we ask a question, we'll give you a pass. You can just say pass, and Pettis and I can riff on it or not. But, you know, we wanted to respect that.
Oh, and I appreciate that so much. It's so important, you know, that everyone who elects their county superintendent and elects their local school board members really do understand that our role is to represent all students, all families. So regardless of their political preference, you know, it's not about the politics for us. It's really about teaching and learning. So in my role as a county superintendent, I have the great pleasure each and every day to support the 24 school districts and the 8 charter schools in our county. And I should probably note that every county across the state of California has their very own county superintendent who also, just like me, provides leadership, support, and service to the school districts that we serve. And what that leadership, support, and service looks like is a little bit different from county to county. So I'm going to speak for our county in saying that our most important role is to ensure that our school districts stay fiscally solvent and that all of our school districts have an approved local control and accountability plan, also known as an LCAP. And that plan is the plan where districts decide their priorities and their goals for their students and really lay out a clear plan of how they plan to spend their funding, both federal, state, and local funding, to support the goals of that school district. We also, of course, provide professional development to teachers, to classified staff, and to school board members. And we also serve students directly. So some of the programs where we provide direct service would be in our special education program, where we operate several schools and, of course, programs that are on other school districts' campuses to serve the moderate to severe special education students. We also serve migrant students. We serve our youngest learners, known as our early learning program, and that's a program where we combine Head Start funds and state preschool funds to provide high-quality preschool programming for the youngest learners. And let's see, we also operate some charter schools. We have a home charter school and an open door charter school. The home charter school serves students that are in homeschool programs or in an independent study fashion. And our open door charter school is a school where we bring back those individuals who have dropped out of school for whatever reason, and we help them to obtain their high school diploma. We also serve students in our alternative education program. And in our alternative education program, that's a combination of both the court schools and the community schools. Now, let me see that I left out a few of our other services that we provide. We provide technology services to the school districts throughout the county. We also provide support for the liaisons for the homeless students or students who have housing insecurity, also known as students that qualify for McKinney-Vento services. And we are also the entity that provides support to our foster youth liaisons within the school districts. So lots and lots of services, whether they're direct services to students or services to the local school districts and charter schools here in Monterey County.
So just so I get a better understanding, so does the county operate charter schools and the local districts can operate charter schools, or are they coordinated through one office?
No, actually, the first is correct. So our County Board of Education has the opportunity to authorize charter schools directly, or they can become the authorizer of charter schools that run independently. So the first two charter schools I was speaking about that we operate, those are charter schools that our county board authorizes and we run. The rest of the charter schools in the county are either authorized by one of their local school districts or authorized by our County Board of Education. So an example of what that looks like is Monterey Bay Charter, or Bayview Charter. Those are just two examples of charter schools that our county board has authorized. And what that means to authorize a charter school is the charter school has to submit a petition that lays out their instructional program and all of the services they'll be providing to students. And then there are several elements that have to be reviewed by our MCOE staff. And then our staff makes a recommendation to the County Board of Education to either authorize or deny authorization of those charter schools. Now, charter schools that want to be authorized by the local school district in which they operate, you know, in their boundary areas, then they submit their petition to that local school district. If a local school district board decides to not authorize a charter school, then they can appeal that denial to our County Board of Education, who then can choose to approve, and then we become the authorizer, or deny if they don't feel that the criteria has been met.
And Pettis, since you brought up the charter school, I'd like to do a follow-up on that.
Sure.
I'd like to talk about charter schools because it's my understanding, Dr. Gus, that they are taxpayer-funded. I know we spoke a little bit about this before, but the National Conference of State Legislatures explains that when asked this question, that charter schools are publicly funded, privately managed, and semi-autonomous schools of choice. Now, Salon did an amazing three-part investigative series on Hillsdale College. And Hillsdale College has inconspicuously been building a network of classical education charter schools, which use public tax dollars to teach that the U.S. was founded on Judeo-Christian principles and that the progressivism is fundamentally anti-American. And then in Orange County, right here in California, they have what they call the Orange County Classical Academy, which opened its doors in August 2020. With sort of a combative flair, the school flew a pro-police thin blue line flag and announced its adoption of a sex ed curriculum that was designed to support parent authority and family values, and will only read work by white men. And I understand that Orange County Charter School is publicly funded. Do you have any thoughts about, you know, charter schools of that nature?
Well, so that's really interesting. I don't know about that particular charter school, but I can tell you this. Because charter schools are publicly funded, they're required by law to follow all of, well, not all, but to follow specific laws, which most of what you just talked about would be prohibited by those laws, because Education Code Section 47605 says that a charter school must be non-sectarian.
That's what I thought, too. But okay, go on. Right.
Charter schools can't discriminate, and they can't charge tuition. And so I know last time we talked, you said, well, you know, they operate like private school. Well, it's interesting because they're not supposed to operate like a private school. Mm. In fact, any existing private school may not be converted to a charter school. That's in the Ed Code as well. So, you know, if they're discriminating or they're trying to charge tuition or if they're not allowing students in because they have developed, you know, some type of criteria that the students have to meet, none of that is actually part of the law. In fact, charter schools have even more requirements because, in fact, let me kind of say it this way.
If I could just make a break, hold that thought. Hold that wonderful thought, because it's time for a break. You are listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM. Many voices, one station. Listen globally online from the KSQD.org website. Our topic today is, what's up, Doc? What's going on with our schools? And we're speaking with the Monterey County Superintendent of Schools, Dr. Deneen Gus. I'm your host, Jill Cody.
Hello, K-Squid listeners. I'm Todd Hartman, and each weekday at 4 p.m., I bring you a different perspective on the news than you're likely to hear on most media outlets. Please join me on KSQD Santa Cruz, your ink spot on the dial for the Tom Hartman program, heard now for the first time ever in the Monterey Bay Area at 90.7 FM, weekdays at 4 p.m. That's Progressive Talking Conversation with me, Tom Hartman, weekdays at 4 p.m. on KSQD 90.7 FM. Tag, you're it.
We're back, and we are speaking with our bold guest, Dr. Deneen Gus, who is the Monterey County Superintendent of Schools, about what the public school system is facing today. And you were going to go on about charter schools.
Yes, so what I was mentioning is that charter schools, in some respects, actually have more restrictions in that they have to have an authorizer in order to operate. So, again, whether it's a county board of education or a local school district, they have to submit a petition for a certain number of years that they plan to operate, and then they can be either denied or they can be granted. And charter schools that are not performing, the authorizer can actually revoke. Or if the charter petition is up, they can choose to not renew that charter school if the charter school isn't doing what it's supposed to be doing. So right now, the way the law states here in California is that a charter school must be approved for a five-year term. But at any time during that five-year term, again, if the school isn't performing or isn't following what they stated they would be doing in their petition, they can be revoked by their authorizer. So in that, I should also mention, they have to also perform at the same standard of academic performance as traditional schools. Now, here's what's interesting, though. The traditional schools, if they are underperforming academically, right, if their students aren't performing at the level they should be performing, those schools can't be closed. But a charter school can be. Because, again, their authorizer has to provide the oversight to make sure that they're doing what they're supposed to be doing and that, in fact, student outcomes show that that charter school is a successful school. So in that respect, they do have even stricter expectations. And, you know, when I'm out and about, I always have people come up to me and say, Dr. Gus, what do you think about charter schools? And some of those individuals are hoping that I'm going to say, I don't support charter schools. You know, all students need to go to the traditional schools within their boundaries. And instead, the way, you know, this is from the heart here, what I say is I support good schools. I don't support bad schools or schools that are underperforming or not meeting the needs of our students. It's really not about charter school or non-charter school. It's about what is the academic program? Are the students thriving? Are the staff members happy to be at work every day? Are the parents very, very pleased with the educational outcomes of their students? That's what should determine whether or not a school is closed or open.
That is such a healthy perspective. Thank you. And to switch the subject a little bit, in a recent CalMatters blog, CalMatters is a nonprofit, nonpartisan state news blog, I read that at the California Republican Annual Convention this past spring, that they're seeking to capitalize on parent anger and have started a Parent Revolt program to take over school boards, which they hope will lead to legislative and congressional gains. Their former party chair, Sean Steele, said about this new state GOP program, quote, "You see, the schools are just in great free fall and chaos. Parents don't want to send their kids there. So this is the time to get people that are otherwise angst-ridden, upset, and powerless." Dr. Gus, first, are schools in great free fall and chaotic? And I'm sure this new California Parent Revolt program will come to Monterey County. What are your thoughts on managing this new revolt effort?
Yeah, so that is a very interesting effort. And I don't know that they actually have correct information. So you talked about the fact that some parents are angry and some parents are not happy with the public school system. But the reality is, when you look at research, that's not really what research shows. In fact, most families, most parents are very happy with their local public schools. When you look at the results of a recent PDK poll, what you'll see is that the rating for communities public schools is actually quite high. It's not low. People are not feeling, I shouldn't say people, not all people feel angry or upset with their public schools. And typically, you know, when they ask questions of, do you have trust and confidence in your community's public school teachers, what you're finding is that, yes, there is a great deal of support for public school teachers and for the local public schools. But when you talk about, you know, topics nationally, then you see a little bit less support because it's all over the place. But again, if you were just out in your grocery store and you ran into, you know, 10 parents and you started asking them what they think about their public schools, I think what you'll find is that the vast majority of parents are very happy with their local public schools, as are many community members. The thing here is that anyone who's running for a school board seat or running for, you know, any kind of position where they need to represent all students, they need to realize that it's not either or. And what I mean by that is it's not parents revolting, because parents shouldn't be excluded from the equation, right? It's a partnership. Schools, good schools, are schools that involve the parents, engage the parents. Parents have a lot of decision-making authority. We have lots of avenues for parents to share their opinions and to give their input into what's happening in their local schools. All schools in California have a school site council where parents can be involved. They also have ELAC, which is the English Learner Advisory Council. So if their child's an English learner, they can give their input on the English learner programs available at their schools. School board meetings, they are open meetings. They are supposed to be transparent. They have to follow the Brown Act, which means they have to make all decisions in public. So, you know, they can't go in the closet, make a decision, hide that, and nobody knows what's going on. No, everything's open to the public, and the public has the opportunity to comment on decisions that school board members are making. In fact, every school board meeting has, whether it's 2 minutes or 3 minutes, it's kind of different from district to district, but all, excuse me, I've just got a little cough going on. Give me 1 second here. I'm talking so much, I'm getting dry.
That's a good sign. You have a lot to say.
I do, because you can tell I'm very passionate about education.
Well, I was wanting to ask this question about schools in great free fall and chaotic, is that I didn't find that myself. I find that people are happy with their schools, and I felt that the premise, the foundation that this Parent Revolt program was based on a faulty premise. So I appreciate your answer very much. Let's see. You know, again, switching the subject a little bit, you know, some parents think students should not be made to feel uncomfortable. Aren't students being uncomfortable sometimes part of the teaching? I'm asking Pettis this.
From my perspective, one of the roles of education is to challenge people's thinking. You know, we don't want groupthink. We want people to think individually, to have different opinions and to talk about those. But what I'm seeing is an attempt to really shut down discussion. That's the thing that, that frustrates me. And it's based on individual, not just personalities, but their political perspectives. And it seems to me that, and I guess we could say even with the integration of school or desegregation, that government was kind of weighing in on this. But I don't quite see the pushback to keep things so that teachers aren't afraid to talk about what I'll just classify as touchy subjects. So how do we move, I guess the question is, how do we move the conversations that we need to have in schools? And I agree that parents should have a role, but at what point does the role become interference from people, being able to really do the teaching that they believe is important for kids to learn? And I understand there are curriculum requirements and those kinds of things, but how do we address this? How do we get back to a place where we can talk in schools and even have heated discussions? Do you have any thoughts about that, Dr. Gus?
Oh, I absolutely do. I completely agree with you. We have to teach kids to be critical thinkers, good collaborators. We have to teach them the skill of debate and civic engagement. And you can't legislate everything. And what I mean by that is, you know, clearly the State Department of Education adopts the curriculum. That's not correct. They adopt the state standards. And then it's the local school boards that adopt their curriculum that's aligned to those state standards. But you can't, you can never know for sure what's going to come up in a classroom in regard to conversation. I'll give you a perfect example. Now, this one's not one of those highly debated topics, but it, I think, gives you an example of what I mean. Years ago, when, I was still in the classroom teaching, during, certain times of the year, we would have conversations with kids about how important it is that they don't smoke, they don't do drugs, that they take care of their bodies, and that we eat healthy and live healthy lives. And for sure, a student, this happened every year, would raise their hand and say, Dr. Gus, my dad smokes cigarettes. Or my mom does such and such. Things just kind of occur naturally in the classroom. And if teachers don't know how to respond or if you take it up a notch and the conversation, isn't a first grader trying to tell you what their parents do at home, but the conversation is about, one of those more topics that are more sensitive or opinions vary, teachers cannot walk on eggshells. They have to be able to naturally respond and really help the young people learn how to be critical consumers. I don't think that we should be teaching kids what to think. That's not our role. But what we do teach kids is how to analyze and how to research and how to evaluate sources of information so that they become good problem solvers and they make their own decisions. That's what it's about. So how do we have, whether you're in a school board meeting, how do we have civil discourse and truly debate the topics? And then in the classroom, how do we help our children develop their critical thinking skills? Those are the questions, right? That's what we're here to do.
If you're just joining us, our topic is, what's up, Doc? What's going on with our schools? And we're speaking with Monterey County Superintendent of Schools, Dr. Deneen Gus. Dr. Gus is here to share with us what it's like today to teach or volunteer to be on a school board. Pettis and I would like to add you to our news group, and you may do so by texting Be Bold America at 22828. Text Be Bold America at 22828. Thank you for signing up. We will be right back with our bold guest, Dr. Deneen Gus, right after Jim Hightower points out that America needs a quality child care system. I'm your host, Jill Cody.
Nearly every nation with an advanced economy, and some not so advanced, treats child care as a fundamental public good, essential to nurturing children, families, and the whole society. But not our U.S. of A. Indeed, our so-called leaders relegate millions of working parents and 21 million kids under five to the tender mercies of a for-profit market, with childcare facilities ranging from impossibly expensive to helter-skelter, unlicensed kiddie corrals. Embarrassingly, while right-wingers mindlessly salute the U.S. as exceptional, they fail to note that what's exceptional about our childcare system is that it's such a shambles it can't even be called a system, much less caring. For the past decade, independent journalist and economic analyst Bryce Covert has documented the worsening social crisis caused by this abject failure of leadership. Two-thirds of our pre-K kids have both parents in the workforce, meaning care outside the home is essential. 85% of the parents say that finding quality, affordable child care in their area is a problem somewhere between serious and impossible. Nationwide, the annual cost for a four-year-old's daycare averages about $13,000. Despite millions of working families finding this essential service unaffordable or even unavailable, political leaders have ignored their plight. Child care aid reaches only 15% of qualified kids. Some callous governors even divert chunks of federal child care subsidies to their own political priorities, such as corporate welfare. In 2017, even before COVID-19 abruptly shut down thousands of care centers, 40% of America's children lived in child care deserts, zip codes with zero programs or so few that two-thirds or more of the area's children are unable to get in. This is Jim Hightower saying, is this the best we can do for the future of our nation? The Hightower Radio Lowdown is brought to you by the Lowdown Happy Hour, live streamed from the Chat and Chew Cafe. Details at HightowerLowdown.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM, Many Voices, One Station. Listen globally online from the KSQD.org website. And our topic today is, what's up, Doc? What's going on with our schools? And one of the docs that we have on our program is Dr. Pettis Perry. And, you know, Pettis, one of the things about that's been a nationwide issue lately is making that parents don't want to make their students uncomfortable about is critical race theory. And talking about race and slavery and white supremacy, what are your thoughts on that, those topics in the public school system?
As you know, Jill, I do a lot of work in the area of diversity, and it is probably one of the most important things we could be tackling at this juncture in our history. We are wrestling with how do we talk to each other and appreciate the differences that we bring to the table, and trying to shut down part of the conversation does nothing but exacerbate it. So saying that we shouldn't talk about race when we hold up race as probably the single biggest divider among people, and we say we can't talk about it, it's preventing us from getting at the issues that may be able to create a framework for us to resolve some of the issues that are related to race. And as we've talked about on other programs, you know, race is really a social construct. But it goes beyond just race, right? What about the HB 1557 bill,
Don't Say Gay bill, right?
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Couldn't get it out of my mouth. But, you know, it's that same sort of issue that things are being made taboo that people need to learn how to talk about, just like we have to learn to talk about sex in an appropriate way. So cutting things off because of, you know, religious belief systems or personal belief systems and not allowing them to get into open dialogue, I think ultimately hurts everyone in the educational system, and I think ultimately our society, because we keep it as a taboo and we say, well, no, we can't talk about that. But yet still, it affects most of the people in this country. Well, I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, well, I just wanted to clarify that the HB 1557 bill is a Florida bill, and it's, you know, unfairly targeting the LGBTQ community and particularly gay and trans students. And so when you're talking about diversity inclusion, it's actually doing the opposite.
Emblematic of the problem, Jill.
Right.
And it talks about the politics in education.
Right. Just also shifting the topic a little bit, back to you, Dr. Gus. The American Library Association stated that every state in the union is facing book banning. And this movement is big in Texas and Florida, but what are you seeing in California or in your county?
Well, so that's a very interesting question. It is true that parents, activists, school board officials, and lawmakers around the country are challenging books at a pace not seen in decades. In fact, the American Library Association said in its 2021 fall report that it received an unprecedented 330 reports of book challenges, each of which can include multiple books. It's actually very interesting. But here in Monterey County, we're not really seeing that as an issue, at least not thus far. You know, there are systems in place, curriculum materials, whether it's math textbook adoptions or English language arts or whatever the subject is, there are systems that are in place that before a book is put on a shelf or a textbook is adopted, you have to go through the system. You have to go through the process. So, you know, I don't know if it's just because we're doing such a great job with that process or if it's more about specific library books that, you know, are becoming not wanted in certain libraries in certain states. I don't know. I do know this. My mother-in-law lives in Florida, and she's a retired paraprofessional, and she calls us pretty regularly and says, I'm so concerned about this book burning. You know, this just isn't right. And I have to say, well, gosh, that's not happening here in Monterey County. But again, there are systems in place before a book gets put, in the hands of a student. There's ways that parents can challenge a book. If they don't think the book is appropriate, they can go to the local librarian, and then there's a process. And there's a way to review books and ensure that those books truly are appropriate and meeting the needs of the young people. And so that might be part of it. I think we're doing a good job of following those processes. I always tell individuals, if you want to have input, then you need to show up. Before a textbook is adopted, it has to go through a very rigorous review. Teachers, multiple teachers, committees, have to review the instructional materials. And then those materials need to be put on public display for a certain period of time so that the community and the parents have an opportunity to review those materials. And then, of course, they're adopted at open board meetings where, again, the public has an opportunity to provide their comments on those materials. And so that's literally what happens. There is a process. We don't just randomly, you know, purchase books, or it's not just one person selecting a book. There are processes in place to make sure that materials are appropriate for the grade level, appropriate for the content area, and that we have received public comment on any material that we would be adopting.
It's so nice to hear that there are systems in place. And what you just said about showing up, that's a great start for Keep, Stop, Start. People need to show up Maybe turn the TV set off for a while. Maybe just go to your school board meeting, show up, find out what's going on. I do have a listener question. I received a question from a professor at Cabrillo College, and I'll just read what he wrote to me. He said, I hope you can ask her what her reactions were to the excellent work of New York University professor Jonathan Haidt, quote, on the coddling of the American mind. The attacks on good academic teaching are not only from the administration and politicals, but from the underlying culture having already infected students. The call-out culture is a greater problem in California and other northern states versus the Christian right taking over. But either way, education is in deep trouble, and without the best teachers in the classroom, the youth of today that you and I are putting so much hope in changing things are going to be adrift. What are your thoughts on that? Listener question, Dr. Gus.
Yeah, so I have to admit, I haven't read the book, but I do understand that it speaks to the fact that on some college and university campuses, there's this culture of students and professors feeling the need to censor themselves. Regardless of their political affiliation, they have to be careful to not offend another campus member, whether it's a student or another professor. And my understanding of the book is that it really talks about three great untruths and how they're contributing to this paranoia. I haven't read the book, but I can speak to how our local districts in Monterey County are actively working to give our students the skills they need to confidently take on challenges that they might face and, gain strength and a sense of self. So let me just talk for a few minutes about my understanding of the three untruths. The first one is, what doesn't kill you makes you weaker. And that states that children are receiving the message that they should avoid pain, discomfort, and bad experiences. Well, educators today are really, truly using innovative methods to encourage discussion, kind of like what Dr. Pettis was referring to earlier. You know, you have to encourage discussion regarding equity in both the current and the historical context. And novel studies and primary sources and, of course, viewing of video clips from various media really inspire discussions and debates that allow our students to experience current conversation topics from different perspectives. And that's what it's about. Everyone is going to hold their own perspective. You know, our educators, they're giving students the tools they need to evaluate the validity of the sources that they're using. I talked about that a little bit earlier. And the courage to seek out and to listen to new ideas that might feel uncomfortable to them at first. But then when they feel more comfortable or better understand the content, then they do gain that ability to feel more comfortable. The second untruth is always trust your feelings. And that basically states that children are receiving the message that they should never question how they feel. And in our county districts and schools, we're actually very invested in bringing social and emotional programs into the classroom and encouraging our students to understand their emotions and understand why they're feeling the way that they're feeling. And, of course, we teach them strategies to work through those emotions so that they can refocus or rebalance back into that classroom setting. And that's why so many of our schools have invested in counseling staff. They've implemented positive behavior and intervention systems, restorative justice programs, and much, much more to help students become introspective with their own emotions and, most importantly, empathetic with their peers' emotions. You have to be able to read the room. You have to know how you are impacting your others and why you have the emotions that you have. And then the third untruth. Life is a battle between good people and evil people. States that children are receiving the message that there are good and evil people in the world with very little room for nuance. Well, our schools are working on giving students a more global perspective, filled with respectful curiosity for those who are different from them, an understanding of various belief systems, and a metacognitive mindset when it comes to their own viewpoint. We really try to teach our students to always assume best intention and be a good listener. So I kind of hope that I've tackled that question, even though I haven't read the book.
Well, I thought you did very well, and I really liked the three untruths being a challenge there. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Monterey County Superintendent of Schools, Dr. Deneen Gus. I'm your host, Jill Cody.
Tune in at 6 p.m. tonight for New Dimensions. New Dimensions features conversations with innovative and inspiring thinkers on a wide range of topics that are timely and timeless. Explore the emerging possibilities for individual and global transformation, honoring the interconnectedness of all life, cross-cultural traditions, and the human spirit. New Dimensions also airs regularly Wednesday at 9 a.m. here at KSQID 90.7 FM, Many Voices, One Station.
You're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM, Many Voices, One Station. Want a friend to hear this interview? Be Bold America is available as a podcast. Now you and your friends may listen from your favorite podcast platform and subscribe for free from Apple, Google, Spotify, Radio Public, and many more. And Pettis, I can just feel it from Bellingham, Washington to Santa Cruz, California, that you have a question.
You must have been watching me pace through your third eye. Dr. Gus, I'm glad to hear that emotional intelligence, if I heard you correctly, is being taught in the classrooms. It's one of the fundamental skills that people, I think, need to have in order to move towards a better life. We have to be able to take care of our emotions. Part of my work also looks at transformative learning and the work that Mesereau and Paulo Freire brought to light in their work. And I hope that that's also part of the teaching curriculum. I had a meeting with the community college a couple of days ago, and that was one of the comments I made to them, that I think we really need to start teaching people models for how to accept things that create disorienting dilemmas for them, which part of this discussion is doing when you're talking about things that make people uneasy. But teaching them that the process that we go through so that they're better able to not only handle difficult conversations, but are better able to handle other forms of trauma that that might upset them. So I hope that that's something that your faculty and that you also take a look at. Do you want to talk a little bit about transformative learning? And if not, then I have another question for you.
Well, I think you covered transformative learning pretty well there. And I can tell you, yes, for the most part, that is part of the social and emotional learning that is happening in classrooms. So let's go right to your next question.
Great. Thank you for that. I wish it had been happening when I was coming through school. And that's one of the reasons I'm so passionate about it. You talk about the way curricula is brought into the books in particular. If a parent, this is really a curiosity question, if a parent doesn't want a child to be exposed to particular materials, is there a way for them to opt their child out like they do in some sex ed programs, I understand, without penalizing the child?
You know, that's a good question, because that whole sex ed piece comes up pretty regularly. A couple of times now, we've had groups come and protest at our county office because they're not happy with the health ed curriculum. And we have to tell them, you know, we totally respect your views. We understand how you feel. But the reality is, we are not the entity that approves the framework or approves the sex ed curriculum or the health curriculum. Those decisions are actually made at the state level by the State Board of Education. And so there is a process. So parents who feel strongly about any of those curriculum pieces that are adopted at the state level. They can give their public comment during the public comment period prior to a framework being adopted. And that happens very frequently. And the reality is there have been a few curricular areas recently where the framework completion has been delayed because they received so much public comment on that particular topic. And I do think that the State Board of Education and all of those individuals that are involved in developing the framework and developing the standards, they really are trying to hear the voices and hear the perspectives of all of the individuals that feel strongly about these materials. But at the end of the day, you're not going to please everyone. I mean, that's just reality. And so I think that we, you know, do have to realize that everyone holds different opinions, thoughts, priorities, likes and dislikes. And so it's important that we do share our thoughts on particular curricular items that are being proposed, but at the same time, respect the fact that those decisions are made, in some cases, at the state level. And then at the local level, we must teach those items. However, with that said, if a parent is very opposed or very concerned, what I recommend that they do is show up at that school board meeting. Well, actually, before they show up at a school board meeting, they really should reach out. They should first talk with the teacher, let the teacher know their concerns, talk with the local administrator of their child's school. And then if they don't feel like their voices have been heard or their concerns are being addressed, then they should go to the district superintendent and, if needed, the local school board. That's the way, that's the process to share their concerns. You know, typically when something is concerning to a parent, the school wants to work with that parent. No educator wants to feel like you're forcing something on somebody. But at the same time, you know, we are expected to teach the locally or the state adopted materials. So how that works, to me, it's kind of a give and take. I was a site principal in years past, and if I ever had a parent that was concerned, I would bring them in. I would hear all of their concerns. I would talk with them. Much of the time, what they were concerned about, once they actually looked carefully into the materials, what they realized was what they thought was happening or what they thought was included really wasn't. They were just hearing rhetoric from someone else. And then when they really, you know, did their own research, they realized that that wasn't the case.
Dr. Gus, we have about 3 minutes left. And I had one more question before we get into the keep, stop, starts. One more question that I wanted to ask you. So maybe your answer can be a minute. I'm sorry to limit you, but I'm running out of time,
no.
Darn it. You know, I think there's a document that I don't think has gotten enough publicity, and that's Rick Scott's 11-point plan to rescue America. And it's what the Republican platform will be if they get control of the House or the Senate or both. And they talk about entitlements would be reauthorized. All retitlements would be reauthorized every 5 years. And, of course, we're concerned about Social Security and Medicare. But how would this affect education and public schools? They also said that they would close the Department of Education. So just quickly.
Wow, that's a hard one to be quick.
I know. We'll have to have you back.
Oh, yes. That would be great. Well, let me just say that, you know, the Federal Department of Education is, it has a function. It's important. The majority of control over the decisions made are really made at the local level. However, at the federal level, when they make decisions about funding coming to school, so, and again, it's lots of different entitlement programs, those are important funding programs for our local schools. And so, if they didn't have the Department of Education at the federal level, who would make those decisions?
Right.
I'd want to learn a lot more about that because we pay our federal taxes. I definitely want to make sure that decisions in regard to how we're receiving certain pots of education funding, that there's some control over that.
Right. So in this last minute, do you have some keep, stop, starts for our listeners?
I do. I really do. I'm so excited to share these. So keep doing. In regard to public education, what we need to keep doing is reinvesting in our public schools. My mother was a teacher for many, many years, and she used to tell me, oh, honey, I'm seeing that, you know, we're not investing in public schools anymore. You watch. Our scores are going to drop. Our schools are going to, you know, not have the resources they need, and that's exactly what happened. But in California, I'm really excited to say that in these last 2 years, California has shown a strong commitment to reinvesting in our public school system, and it will pay off. It's going to take us a few years to get the outcomes we're looking for, but it will pay off.
When we have 30 seconds.
Oh, shoot. Okay.
I know.
Start doing. Well, let me say this. Stop doing. Stop underfunding schools. We need the funding. Teachers are not well paid. They can't even afford to buy a house these days. That's not okay. They shouldn't have to buy their own classroom supplies. Not good. Start doing. Get involved in your local school community. Even if you don't have children currently in the school system, get involved. And one way to do it is here in Monterey County, we offer a program called Inside Education, where we literally put you on buses and take you out to the local school, take you into classrooms where you get to see firsthand teaching and learning.
Oh, that is an excellent program. Dr. Gus.
And it's free.
Oh, and it's free. Not many things are free. Dr. Gus Pettis and I are so grateful that you could join us on Be Bold America. Thank you for all you do. You have a vital and, in my view, one of the most untenable, yet one of the most important positions in education. Your success is our success. Our future depends on it. Thank you for being our bold and impressive guest today.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. It's a pleasure to serve, and it was a pleasure to spend this hour with you.
It was a pleasure to have you. What's next on Be Bold America? On September 11th at 5 p.m., we will be speaking with our friend of the show, Tom Hartman. Tom is returning for his fourth time to tell us about his new book, The Hidden History of Neoliberalism. Tom will reveal how and why neoliberalism became so prevalent in the United States, and why it is time for us to turn our backs on it. America is at a crossroads regarding its economic future, and many of us don't fully understand how we got here. Tom will demystify neoliberalism and will explain how we can use this pivotal point in time to create a more positive future for ourselves and for our country. That will be on Be Bold America, September 11th at 5 p.m. Remember, Be Bold America is available on a podcast. Now, you may listen to the show anytime for free wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give a special thank you to Be Bold America's program engineer, Eliza James, and the station's program director, Howard Feldstein. And again, to our bold friend, Dr. Deneen Gus, Monterey County Superintendent of Schools. You're listening to KSQD Santa Cruz, Many Voices, One Station. Listen worldwide online at ksqd.org. Stay tuned for New Dimensions. My name is Jill Cody.
And I'm Dr. Pettis Perry.
Thank you for listening to Be Bold America. Until next time, keep, stop, start.